we'll proceed to the second case of the morning, Irwin versus OS Restaurant Services. Mr. Sapolsky?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jamie Sapolsky, and I'm representing the plaintiffs. The district court here denied class certification because of a claimed incompatibility between the opt-in procedure of Section 216B and the opt-out procedure of Rule 23. The court called these two procedures clearly incompatible. Other courts have referred to them as inherently incompatible. But in either case, the assertion is that the congressional intent in the passage of the Portal to Portal Act is thwarted by these so-called dual or hybrid actions.
So, Mr. Sapolsky, should we read the district court's opinion as simply an across-the-board ruling that an FLSA opt-in action can never be combined with a B3 opt-out action? Is there anything particular to the facts of this case that suggests that maybe it wouldn't be very manageable here, but in some other circumstance it might be?
No, it's the former, Judge. And what the district court is saying is that if this 216B action is filed in combination with a state law class action in federal court, and there's an exception that he carves out that I'm going to get to in a moment, but
the removal.
Yes, Judge. if the action is filed in federal court and it's a dual or a hybrid action, it falls within the court's incompatibility argument. And of course, this is not the first time that the district court here has ruled on that. There was the Garibay case, and going back to 07, there was the Riddle v. NSA case. But this is a issue of first impression, but it is a straightforward one. And that is, does the opt-in requirement of Section 216B apply to claims that are filed under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or does it somehow affect all wage and hour claims? The answer is straightforward, and that is that the 216B requirement applies to Fair Labor Standards Act claims only.
Of what significance, if any, is it that, in at least as I understand this record, in this case, the basis of the court's jurisdiction over your state claims is supplemental jurisdiction? I think there may be diversity of citizenship, but I can't imagine how the amount in controversy could be met. So let's just assume, and you've alleged, I guess, only supplemental jurisdiction.
Yes.
Would this be different if there were diversity jurisdiction over the state law claims?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because while the supplemental jurisdiction issue is one of long standing, and that goes back all the way to Judge Shader's decision in the Texan in 2001, where the court there finds not only is this issue, I don't think he used the term back then, of inherent incompatibility, but he says that this thwarts Congress's intention in the Portal to Portal Act. But he also says this is an issue of Section 1367A because there's and he begins to talk about the question, and I think he refers to this as the joinder being something that needs to be apparent. It betokens actual joinder. So he does get into the question about 1367A. I don't think that the issues here matter whether we're talking about federal jurisdiction or whether we're talking about federal question jurisdiction or whether we're talking about something else. But I should also mention that what complicates the district court's decision here is the fact that in recent years we have now the CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, and now we might have a hybrid action that's brought in the federal court that alleges federal question jurisdiction under the FLSA, alleges CAFA jurisdiction under the state class action, and I don't know how to be able to reconcile that with the decision of the district court here. But the court's decision, as I say, the issue is straightforward because we're dealing with primarily the language of the Portal to Portal Act. Nothing in the legislative history indicates either that Congress intended to foreclose or circumscribe state wage and hour laws, and in fact, to the contrary. Again, the opt-in clause of 216 refers specifically to claims filed under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that is section 206, 207, 215A3. So the text of 216B does not go to state law claims.
So I have another question for you. One of the things that your opponents suggest is that maybe we don't need to think about all of this because the district court anyway adopted the magistrate judge's view that the common questions didn't predominate for B3, so that would be an independent reason to reject a B3 class.
Your Honor, what the magistrate judge did in the report and recommendation is to say that every claim, we identified three different classes, two under minimum wage and overtime and one under the Wage Payment and Collection Act. For every claim that we alleged, the court, the magistrate found that we had met all the requirements under Rule 23, with the exception of...
This was the tip pool people?
Yes.
Yeah.
It had to do, Judge, with whether tipped employees were required to perform tip work at a tip credit subminimum wage rate. On that issue, the magistrate found that there was no predominance. Of course, accepting the fact that the district court already had the Riddle decision from 07, and so the magistrate judge felt compelled to say, this doesn't meet superiority under Rule 23b3 because it's incompatible.
Are you appealing on the determination that the inquiries would be too individualized as to tip workers doing non-tip work?
No, Judge.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not asking you to argue about it.
Okay. Sorry.
I just want to make sure that's out of the case. But the point that Judge Wood was asking about is, in essence, this tension between the general adoption of the magistrate's recommendation and the footnote that says
right. This
issue's out. Mm.
That's correct, Judge. And so the court never decides the issue of mm-hmm. predominance under that particular mm-hmm. tip work issue. In addition, the statute 218A states that recognizes that there is going to be that state laws will be enacting wage and hour laws that also grant greater benefits to the employees of the state, and when they do, those will also trump the Fair Labor Standards Act. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Romhead?
May it please the Court. My name is Dean Romheld. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor, who's participating as an amicus in this appeal. The focus of the decision below was squarely on the issue of incompatibility. The district court below held, and I think in response to an earlier question, that there is really an automatic or per se bar to Rule 23B class actions when there's also the presence of an FLSA collective action. And it's certainly the Secretary's position that nothing in the FLSA compels such a result, and that a Rule 23 or state law wage and hour claim should be evaluated under its particular merits under Rule 23 without any regard to the FLSA or Section 16B. Appellees in their brief characterize the judge's decision as a case management decision, and I think it's the only fair reading of the district court's decision is that it was squarely about incompatibility.
The judge was worried, though. I guess there is a case management aspect to this. The judge was worried that if people got forms that apparently conflicted or forms that were giving them different instructions, they'd get confused. You know, the FLSA, if you want in, you know, return this form. If it's the Illinois wage statute, you're in unless you opt out, and people would just get flummoxed by getting these different sets of instructions.
Well, I guess that was actually one of the magistrate's concerns. I know the particular district court judge here has held in previous case the Riddle matter that such possibility for confusion is not grounds alone for denial of a Rule 23b action.
Well, the district courts, not only in the Seventh Circuit but all over the country, have been all over the block on this question.
Well, I think not on the confusion issue. I mean, certainly there is a split on the incompatibility issue. On the confusion issue,
what kind of experience do we have with real confusion?
I don't think there is much. I mean, there are certainly the few district court judges who've raise confusion as a possibility have done so in a very theoretical way. It seems
well, presumably, we obviously know that a lot of district judges are letting these cases go forward.
Right.
And I'm interested to know if they've run into serious problems.
I'm certainly not aware of a case where a district court judge has spoken from experience saying that there is this possibility of confusion.
I think whether it's more confusing to receive one form in one hybrid case or two forms in two separate cases.
Yeah, I mean, some of the district court judges have expressly pointed out that the fact that you would have the one court giving a notice explaining the two actions seems a lot less confusing than two courts giving two separate notices at two different times. Focusing on the incompatibility issue again, the text, you know, it's certainly the Secretary's position that the text of 16B as well as the text of the Portal to Portal Act resolve this question. The text of 16B is, on by its plain terms, limits the application of the written consent, the opt-in requirement, to the, you know, limited private rights of action that are available under Section 16B. And it's worth noting that the Portal to Portal Act, which was the 1947 amendment to the FLSA that created or put the opt-in provision into the FLSA, specifically noted that that opt-in provision, that written consent requirement, only applies to actions under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's Section 5 of the Portal to Portal Act.
At the time, Rule 23 was essentially an opt-in provision. They called them spurious class actions under what was the predecessor to 23b3.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
That is correct.
But there certainly was.
She's
certainly
right.
some courts have said that this was a decision, in 1947 against an opt-out alternative.
Was it the union representatives were
coming
in?
I think the concern that was expressed on the floor of Congress at the time was that you would have a union. The FLSA originally, when it was enacted, allowed representative actions,
which would have been pretty much union people, right?
Right. The concern was that a union boss many miles away was bringing an act, who had no particular claim himself or herself, was bringing a claim on behalf of other people with or without their consent. And what the Portal to Portal Act did was obviously eliminate those representative actions, but certainly allow collective actions to proceed by employees on behalf of themselves and those similarly situated. And as part of that removal or elimination of representative actions, the written consent requirement was added. There's certainly nothing. The issue that was bothering Congress in 1946 and 1947 was an FLSA issue. There was a flood of FLSA lawsuits after the Mount Clemens decision that resulted in, at least Congress is concerned that industry was seriously threatened by these actions. So to resolve an FLSA problem or an FLSA concern, as they saw it, they took to amend the FLSA. There certainly was no indication of any intent at the time to affect state laws, to keep all wage and hour plaintiffs out of federal courts, which is something that Congress could certainly do.
And nothing in the 1966 amendments to Rule 23 that really engages in this?
I think if the advisory committee notes to that amendment simply note that Rule 216B is opt-in requirement. Right, and that's simply a different process, and certainly as part of Rule 23 there was, they have to obviously, the opt-in requirement in Section 16B obviously trumps the change to Rule 23 with respect to particular FLSA actions. But it's worth noting that at that time there was no concern that there was some incompatibility between the two. It's also worth noting that when supplemental jurisdiction statute was expanded, I think it was in 1990, Congress didn't see, as it sort of encouraged federal courts to, retain jurisdiction over related state law claims, it didn't carve out wage and hour claims. It didn't feel see the need to, which if there really was this issue of incompatibility, what you think would have been the logical result. And it's also worth mentioning under CAFA, which again pushes state law, qualifying state law claims into federal court, you know, again, there was no sort of need to carve out state wage and hour claims because I think there's just no perception of incompatibility within Congress. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Romhill. Mr. DeCamp.
May it please the Court. When we talk about class actions, there's lots of talk always about legal rules and doctrine and not a lot of talk about people and about claimants. I think it's important to understand exactly why this kind of issue matters here in this case.
But before you get into that,
sure.
I have to say, reading the district court's opinion especially, as informed by the magistrate judge's opinion, but really it's this district court judge, I see no room for case-by-case treatment here. This judge is of the view that the 216B process is just fundamentally incompatible with Rule 23B3. Would you agree with that?
For cases filed in federal court, yes.
Why in the world would a removed case be different? The judge says that, but I found that entirely unpersuasive.
We certainly respect what the district court said. I would infer that the rationale is that in a case that's been removed, there's at least a possibility that the defendant is engaged in some sort of procedural gamesmanship to get into federal court and create this conflict with Rule 23 versus the FLSA. And I think it may be that concern that arguably tipped the equities. That wasn't a focus of our briefing.
That doesn't have anything to do, really, with whether the procedures or whether the recipients will be confused or whether the procedures are incompatible. Well, one of the problems I have with this notion of incompatibility, at least in a case like this one, where the state claims are coming in through supplemental jurisdiction, is that the supplemental jurisdiction statute itself in 1367A expressly contemplates that the additional claims are fine. It says such supplemental jurisdiction shall include claims that involve the joinder or intervention of additional parties. And, in fact, it's routine in litigation that you may have one lineup of parties for count one and a somewhat different lineup of parties for count two and so on and so forth. So I don't see where the problem is, actually. 23B3 has its own independent requirements, which I'm sure you're fully prepared to argue should this go forward on that ground, predominance and superiority and all, you know, all the 23A factors and all the rest of it. I just don't see why that isn't enough protection.
Thank you for raising the question, because I think that goes to the heart of why this issue really matters. When we're talking about just a Rule 23 class in a case that doesn't have an FLSA component to it, we have this sort of comfortable fiction that we have to adopt that the claim is really about protecting the rights of a broad class of oppressed workers in an employment case. And we get there through the due process.
And that's a fiction. Why?
Because what we have is people who are in the case by virtue of not submitting an opt-out form.
And presumably they don't opt out because they really don't care enough to opt out. Or maybe they're glad the case is going forward and they don't have to assume any costs.
Precisely.
We don't know.
Precisely. And that is why we allow those cases to go forward, and it makes sense, and Congress has authorized it, and that's fine. What's different about a hybrid case is that now we do know the quantum of interest by, in this case, more than 89% of the putative Rule 23 class members, that their interest in this case ranges from zero to I don't care enough to fill out a four-line opt-in page and send in a one-page form.
But what inference should we take from that? I mean, all it means is that there's a certain number of people who have chosen to pursue their Fair Labor Standard Act rights, and then there's a different group of people who are pursuing the Illinois claims. Now, had there been diversity, or had this been a CAFA claim, or maybe it was a Title VII claim, so there was federal question jurisdiction over the remainder of the claims, you could wind up with exactly the same lineup of people. And indeed, in class action, sometimes the named representative is suing individually and also as a representative of the class. These kinds of distinctions happen all the time.
True, but in a case like this one, where the state claim and the federal claim are essentially the same.
No, but they aren't. I mean, at least one of the claims is not. the same. One of them, I think, overlaps very substantially.
Right. The Wage Payment and Collection Act claim has some of the common nucleus, but also has some separate aspects to it. But the three minimum wage law claims under state law directly overlap and wrap around the federal claim.
And the, why it's not the fact that the Fair Labor Standards Act actually affirmatively gives states the authority to give workers a higher level of protection. Why isn't that the reason that we should not be concerned about that?
Because it's not. This is not about preemption. I'm not standing before the court saying that the FLSA bars Rule 23 class actions for wage recoveries under state law. That's not our position, never has been.
You want two separate lawsuits? Wouldn't that be claim splitting on the part of the people who are involved in the FLSA suit?
And that comes back to the point that I intended to open with, which is that you would not have claim splitting. There seems to be this presumption throughout the briefing on the plaintiff's side that there are going to be these two classes out there, whether in one case or in two. But I don't think that that's correct.
Sure there will. I mean, you could have your FLSA case in federal court, your opt-in case with the 35 people or whatever it was, and then in state court you could have the class action proceeding under the Illinois wage payment statute and the Illinois equivalent of the FLSA, and you would have two lawsuits going. They would be largely overlapping, at least just to some of the people. Maybe other people would be brought in. The Illinois class action rule is not very different from the federal rule.
That's possible, but the point I'm making is that with regard to the plaintiffs who are the named plaintiffs in this case, for them to proceed with both claims would be claim splitting. That would not be appropriate. And then the question becomes back to...
Well, why can't they be part of the state class action since additional relief is being sought? Now you really are trying to move them out of court.
Not really. The point is that for these named plaintiffs, the people who are opt-ins in the federal case, they have decided that they're interested in pursuing their federal rights and that they are allowed, in this case certainly, to pursue their state law claims as well. The point.
I don't see, where is Rule 23 modified in that way? I don't see anything in 216B that says this supersedes the later enacted 1966 version of Rule 23.
It doesn't. The text does not. The point is that as a matter of superiority, when you have the uncomfortable dissonance of knowing that nearly 90% of this class has no beef with this employer,
Can I just ask you about that a little bit more, Mr. DeCamp? Does your argument depend upon the response rate for the FLSA requests?
No, it depends on...
It sounds like it does.
Well, we certainly know in this case that there's that uncomfortable dissonance, but we also know that in FLSA cases, generally, the opt-in rates are very low, typically in the 15 to 30% range.
Okay, so what? I mean, because presumably there are some cases in which... some well-organized lead plaintiffs can go out. Obviously, look, if we're talking about folks who've been working in a restaurant, they're likely to be fairly mobile. They're going to be hard to track down. Yeah. I've handled class actions like that, and it's a real – you get low response rates always. There may be other situations in which you might get a response rate of 50%, 70%, 80%. Should we have a different rule in those cases?
No, Your Honor. The point would be that –
we should keep those out too.
Yes.
And split them into two cases.
And here's why. With regard to people who have opted into an FLSA claim, it's clear that they have a dispute with the employer. They're interested in pursuing it. That's fine. With regard to individuals who have chosen not to opt into an FLSA case, we're essentially creating a controversy for people who have really said they have no interest in pursuing it. It's really a claim for attorney's fees in search of a claimant.
You could say that about a great number of B3 class actions, and indeed lots of people have said that about a great number.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But the difference is, with a hybrid case, you have, smacking you right in the face, a significant and in most cases, most FLSA cases, an overwhelming majority of the putative Rule 23 class members who have made the affirmative choice not to join the case. So whose rights are we really protecting in a case like this? Well, they said they don't want to take the same dispute, which certainly, at least with the minimum wage claims, is the same dispute under state and federal law. There would be res judicata, et cetera. They don't have a beef with the employer, so why are we going to gin one up? So there could be a state law class action, but the point of the state law class action would be that people who have opted in the federal case, especially people who have pursued certification, would not be able to bring those cases. If they can find other people, other claimants who have not opted into the federal case, fine. And certainly these plaintiffs have every interest in full recovery. The folks who have appeared before this court, who have appeared before the district court, opted in. They can pursue their state law remedies, longer statutes of limitations, et cetera. That's perfectly fine. But there's no need for two class actions to vindicate the same rights. That's our point, that as a matter of superiority, is it reversible error for the district court to say we're at least going to consider and give some respect to the affirmative choice made by the FLSA non-opt-in individuals, but they don't have a beef with the employer? Can we give that some weight?
Mr. DeCamp, can I ask you the same question I asked Mr. Romhilt, and that is we obviously have a lot of district courts that have expressed concern about this potential for confusion. I think I once wrote something along those lines myself. But do we have any actual evidence of such confusion in cases that have gone forward on a hybrid basis?
Right. I'm not aware of any. I think all that we know is low opt-in rates, low opt-out rates. Essentially, everybody takes these things and throws them out, and a handful of people opt in. That's typically how these cases go. You don't have a lot of inquiry into, was anybody confused? That's not something that comes up in the depositions. It's just not a part of what the factual development
or in settlement settlement hearings.
Oh, right. Okay. To me, it's certainly not beyond the pale for a district judge to say, look, this could be confusing to people, to have two separate procedural regimes. They can pursue their state law rights if they choose to opt in. That's fine. If they don't want to opt in and they want to pursue their state law rights in another case, they can do that. We're not cutting off people's rights. What we're not doing is giving rise to this free-floating class action under state law when we know that most of the class, or we can certainly infer that the high likelihood is that most of the class doesn't really have much of a beef with the employer. Are we going to gin up a dispute for the sake of jacking up the attorney's fees? That's really what the case is about. When you have the dissonance of low opt-in and low opt-out.
I'm not sure I agree with the attorney's fees point you're making. First of all, in class actions, they're under the control of the court anyway, so if the court thinks that the fees are higher than they should be, the court has been encouraged through recent amendments to Rule 23 itself to apply a firm hand to that. I think your point about the general tendency of the population to toss things in the wastebasket is correct, and that's not because they like what's going on with them. It's normally because either they're, you know, busy with their lives and they think, okay, you know, I'm in this class action. If I don't opt out, that's fine. I'll wait for the notice, if they even give it that much thought. And I would say the same. I'm reluctant to draw too much of an inference from that fact of human behavior.
I understood, Your Honor, but I think another point to make here is that what we're talking about is an abuse of discretion standard. And
but we aren't, because you agreed that this was really an across-the-board rule, that there is never a Rule 23B class action that can coincide with a 216B FLSA action. And if that's true, then that's just a rule of law, the way we're supposed to coordinate two different things that are there in the books.
But with due respect, I don't think that that's really what the court did. It did say that for this judge, yes, that will be the judge's practice, but I can say that...
No, but that's a rule of law. I mean, we can't have one rule of law if it's Judge Guzman and a different rule of law if it's Judge Kennelly.
Your Honor, absolutely we can. We're talking about discretionary rulings. There are rulings all the time where you know if you get this district judge, they're going to be lenient on discovery. This district judge is going to be tight on discovery.
This is different. This is the way statutes are being read.
With regard to, is the class action a superior method? We're not saying no supplemental jurisdiction. That would be a rule of law. We're not saying preemption. That would be a rule of law. We're saying on the superiority factor, which is committed to the sound discretion of the district court, that the judge has the discretion to have his or her practice on this issue, that it's not beyond the pale. And it's a very broad standard they have. It is not beyond the pale for the judge to...
You'd like to see us write an opinion that says, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Everybody do your own thing.
Effectively, or else
in other words, you would have some district judges who would then combine these things, as we now have, and you'd have to say, well, that was up to you. So in these cases, let's go forward with the 216B plus the 23B3. And then you'd have other judges who didn't. I can't believe that's the position you would be taking.
It is. Any other result would mean taking over, stepping in, and writing the standard for the district court and not respecting the abuse of discretion standard.
Mr. DeCamp, sorry. I guess I'm having trouble understanding why you and your client would prefer two lawsuits and why you'd rather be defending a B3 class action in state court while you're defending the 216B collective action in federal court.
Well, that's exactly the point. We don't prefer two lawsuits. We don't
that's
say
what you'd get. All you have to do is have the lawyers talk to one person who's interested in opting in and say, hey, instead of opting in, why don't you be my named plaintiff in the state court action where we can get all this extra relief under Illinois law? And the person says, yeah, okay. You know, I worked at an Outback steakhouse, and I didn't, you know, I was getting paid the tip rate and don't think I should have been. Boom, you've got your two actions.
If lawyers want to do that, lawyers can do that. They have the option to do that. I don't know that that's
and
what
we're saying. And the clients have the option of saying, I'll be the named plaintiff in the state court action. I think I'll get a better deal.
I think that highlights the ethical issues of plaintiff's lawyers in class actions about steering a plaintiff toward one remedy or one forum versus
another.
What's
wrong with a lawyer giving advice to a plaintiff saying, if you go the state action route, you will have a wider range of remedies, and so that's a choice you should consider making?
What substantive
what's
right?
What's wrong with that?
I would submit that the plaintiff does not have a substantive right to pursue multiple class actions. That is,
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, one of the people making a deliberate choice instead of opting in federal court. You yourself said this would be fine. If you didn't opt in the federal court, you could go file your class action
Correct.
In the state court. And if the lawyer put the options on the table for people and somebody said, okay, I'll be the named representative in the state court action, and now we'll certify the state equivalent of a 23B3, and there you are, as Judge Hamilton is saying, defending the two cases.
Understood.
Very and easy.
Yes, and if the plaintiffs wanted that, if the workers wanted that, okay. If what you have, though, is lawyers steering them strategically, okay, this group of plaintiffs, we're going to have you bring the FLSA opt-in action in federal court, and you other folks are going to have you bring a state law class action in either form, I think the court would have to take a serious look at that. Was that an appropriate ethical thing for a lawyer to do?
Sure it is. I mean, well, you're just complaining about the opt-in procedure, the opt-out procedure, but that you're supposed to give people notice, and if they don't want to be part of that lawsuit, they can say I'm out.
It's not a problem with the opt-out procedure. It's
sure
a problem. Respectfully, no, Your Honor. It's a problem with having an opt-in class where you know that the people who chose not to opt in have very little interest or no interest in raising the same dispute against the employer, and yet they're being shoehorned in.
But you would not foreclose them from bringing their separate action, right?
For the folks who have not opted in, correct, because that would be preemption, and we're not arguing for that.
Right. Okay. So it's perfectly okay.
Mr. Camp, would you envision under the scenario you suggest that there be stays probably in one jurisdiction while the one lawsuit proceeded?
Not necessarily. I think that the courts would want to take a close look at, is there overlap? To what extent do the groups of people overlap? I think certainly whether the Rule 23 cases brought as a separate case or brought in state court, it would be prudent and appropriate for the judge handling the Rule 23 case to see how the FLSA case pans out, because if there is indication, which you don't otherwise have in a Rule 23 case, a very low to no interest in pursuing the claim against the employer, it would certainly, as a jurisprudential matter, as a matter of superiority and case management, be appropriate for the court to give the opt-in rate some degree of weight in the process. Absolutely, Your Honor. I see that my time has expired. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to stay for just a moment with this issue of two actions. First of all, the magistrate judge in his report and recommendation indicated that his recommendation to the court that he would deny class certification of the state claims for the reason of incompatibility, and he would recommend that they be dismissed without prejudice for refiling in state court. And presumably that would have been something that the court would have gone along with. Secondly, there is, we cite the Garibay case, Garibay v. Garden Fresh. Garibay is a case also with this district court that was the same circumstance occurred, and the case was refiled as a state class action in the Chancery Court of Cook County. So for Mr. DeCamp to suggest that the state claim is going to somehow go away.
Were people confused?
Your Honor?
Were people confused?
Well, we haven't gotten to the notice stage, but Judge, I echo Mr. Romhilt's suggestion that I believe confusion is going to be increased by having two separate notices from two different lawsuits and two different courts. The final thing I'd like to mention is that counsel talked at some length about the superiority argument and that the court is is somehow trying to assess what the opt-in rate is going to be as against what the class size would the state law class size. I mean, that simply wasn't done here. And as you know, Judge Wood, this judge has made a definitive statement of law as to what can be filed in federal court and what cannot be. And so we ask that the court...
Well, why couldn't we cut back on the breadth of his approach in this case?
Judge, I don't know how to do that.
And not make it a matter of law, but rather a question of the abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, that's exactly, I think, what we're asking for. What we're asking for is that this hybrid action be treated just like any other pendant class action, and that is you determine whether you've complied with the requirements of Rule 23A and B, and you determine whether there's any specific reasons under Section 1367C that would preclude declining jurisdiction, and if those are met, then the court should certify the state law class. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.